When I went to work for Goldwater, I'd been an editor of Newsweek and a number of good things like that. And when I went to work for him, his attack on the central government was the best thing that was going. Nobody else was attacking it. And my notion is it doesn't make much difference who's attacking the state. If anybody is, that's better than no attack at all. So I thought that was a pretty good man to work for. And as a matter of fact, I would still think that, except that he's changed his mind. I haven't changed my mind. So far as I'm concerned, so long as the state's there, I'm going to be unhappy and trying to eliminate it, which I thought was what being a Republican at one time was supposed to be, you know, that it was really a political movement against the state. That's a slight error, incidentally, but but nevertheless, it's an easy one to make. When you look at Democrats, you know, and then look at Republicans in terms of state power, there's not much choice. So being a Republican seemed cool at one time. But lately, Goldwater has said such things as that the power to make war is too important to be entrusted first to the Congress, and secondly, to the people, that it's so important that it must be entrusted only to the president. Well, I think that's a change, because when I knew him, he was saying things like the president has become an elected monarch and shouldn't have any power at all. And it was my distinct impression that what Richard Revere called the Goldwater Caper, which is about what it was an attempt to abolish the job. Because it was my notion, romantic as it seems now, that if Goldwater had won, that he would have so seriously attacked, deliberately, diminished the power of the presidency, that there could have been a very serious reconstitution of government in this country, something that's still very badly needed, and which at that time seemed possible to do by electoral processes. I don't think that's true at this point anymore. So at any rate, while, as I say, he was attacking the state, things were fine. And a little later on, let me give you a little insight on something I think is very interesting. After the 64 election, I did something that no Republican I ever met had ever done. I went to work, and this can have a devastating effect on you, because I had got fairly rich, as a matter of fact, by not working, because if you're pretty verbal, you can make an awful lot of money in this country by working for people like Newsweek or for politicians. It's just an interesting tip-off, it seems to me, that there are a lot of guys in this country who have got fairly rich by writing for politicians. Now, that tells us something about politicians, it strikes me. That is to say, if they have to have people write for them, it's quite conceivable that they have to have people read for them, too. In fact, what you're describing is a functional illiterate, which, as a matter of fact, is what most politicians turn out to be. That is to say, their job is not to think or to say anything. Their job is to get elected. And as I am now convinced, thinking is a detriment to that. I still think that the Goldwater campaign raised too many real issues to have been a successful political campaign. It was a didactic campaign. But at any rate, after that, I did go to work, and I became a commercial welder, which is a very important point, because as a Republican, as you may remember if you follow esoteric politics, there was a lot of talk about the individual and his or her place in society. And I thought that they were talking about it, say, in the terms that Emma Goldman had talked about the place of the individual in society, which is the best possible way to talk about it, it seems to me. But it turns out that really wasn't true, that when you hear people as, like, for instance, William F. Buckley, Jr., I wonder who Senior really is or was. All right, when you hear people like that talking about the rights of the individual or the place of the individual in society, if you look very closely, you discover that what they're talking about are certain individuals. That is to say, it is pretty clear that William F. Buckley, Jr., who was brought up on a very high-protein diet and was taught two or three languages before he was 10, not because he's a genius, but because he's rich, is a certain kind of person who, when he talks about people being able to do everything for themselves, is talking about the kind of person who, for instance, is so self-reliant that when he wants his yacht brought around from Sweden, there'll be somebody to sail it for him. Now, there are a few people in this country who, when they have their yacht brought around from Sweden, have to do it themselves. They are known as poor people. And this is about the that's about the Republican concept of a poor person, someone who has to drive their own Cadillac. Now, when you go to work, from having been a mandarin for these guys and from having made a lot of loot at it, you discover something that's quite compelling. You discover that the truth of the matter is that all of these people you're now working with, I worked on heavy equipment when I was, I still do somewhat, but I did it steadily for a while. And as a welder working on heavy equipment, you're usually upside down under something that is very big and very heavy and very greasy. And it's usually burning after you've welded it for a couple of minutes. And there are usually a lot of people around. And you discover that these people who never once entered into your calculations, really, when you're talking all of this high rhetoric, that these people are actually totally, absolutely capable of self-management. They are ingenious, intelligent, can solve real problems, and have a great tendency to be cooperative, which is not true of politicians who are solely competitive. Now, when you begin to see this happening with these people you're working with, you think back very quickly to the people you used to work with who are incompetent, who cannot solve problems unless given a staff report, who, if left alone under any ordinary circumstances, wouldn't be able to feed themselves, who are not cooperative in any sense, who are highly competitive and whose notion of success, of course, is not what they can create, but the people they can destroy, because the notion of success in politics is how many bodies are below you, how many corpses you have created, because the whole political process is that destructive. It's who you can kill off. You notice that there's only one guy who comes out at the end of each of these contests. And so it's that kind of lethal concept. These other people are quite different. So I began really rethinking everything that I had ever known and had known for a long, long time, or thought I had known, and came out with some conclusions which I am told are very left in nature. So since I decided that I was beginning to think like a communist, maybe it was time to read some literature. So I started reading. Now this may seem unusual too. When I tell you that of all the politicians I've worked with, and that includes a lot of them, like I wrote the only known book that Mel Laird has ever written, and a few things like that, I really worked with a lot of these people. I will tell you this, and it is true, to the best of my knowledge, not one of them has read heavily in left works at all, that their total information on Marxism, for instance, comes from the FBI, which has for years maintained a service for congressmen, a service that provides them with information on what Marxism is, on what communism is, on what socialism is, so that they, again, don't have to think, which is probably a very pragmatic decision by the FBI, because it's not a clear thing at all that these people can think. Therefore, giving them this information may be a kindness, among other things. But nevertheless, the average information on the right wing, so-called right wing, in this country about the left is absolutely and totally distorted, to a degree that I am prepared to bet any of my ex-right friends, and I've seen it work time after time, that if they would read in the originals of left literature, particularly the classics, that they would discover that their positions, if they're rather honest, say, Thoreau-type right-wingers, old isolationist conservatives and so forth, that they would find that their positions actually have originated in the left of politics historically, that that's the origin of their positions. As, for instance, I wrote a book after the 64 campaign in which I described in a long, rolling passage my concept of the left. It's a very accurate description of something, but it's absolutely not a description of the left, because it says, in effect, that the left treats man as economic man, when, of course, it was the breakthrough not only of Marx and Engels, but of people like Stirner and others. It was the breakthrough of the left historically to start treating men not as economic man, but as social. So that what I had described, I discovered to my chagrin after I reread that and a number of other things, was precisely corporate capitalist view of man, which is, of course, absolutely that he is not social in nature, but is wholly economic in concept. Well, that came as a bit of a shock, a revealing one, and so I thought it would be a good idea to start testing out some other information that was involved. As, for instance, SDS on the right had been known, again, thanks to the FBI. Incidentally, your friendly FBI, as one of you knows well, it's interesting, we never know, you never know which one, you just know one. As one of you knows very well, one of the things your friendly FBI does is to provide for responsible journalists, and I was once as responsible as any of them, regular dossier material on all suspicious people. You get in the mail, characteristically, once, twice a week, an envelope, a bulge with Xerox copies of raw file information with the index numbers all blanked out, but you know where it comes from. And so that while you're writing about dangerous subversives in and out of government, you will have a lot of information to throw in, which is why you get some very curious references by columnists, you know, who are able to say things sort of things like when he was 17, he was caught deflowering an owl or something like that. And you wonder how in the hell anybody could dig up this stuff. Well, you don't have to, because I remember one thing that I will never forget. A very close friend of mine over the past few years has been a fellow whose nickname, he's with the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions, his nickname is Ping, and his nickname is Ping because his brother's nickname was Pong, which is a pre-visit situation. But nevertheless, when the FBI, when I was a responsible journalist, sent me all the information on what a deadly communist this guy was, because he was against war and things like that. And if that doesn't make you a communist, friends, there are a few other easy things. Like if you're black, that's another thing that'll get you into the FBI's notion of communist. But nevertheless, when they sent this stuff about what a vile fellow he was, they also suggested, in a sort of dramatic aside, that it would be, it was amusing to note that a lot of people referred to him not as Ping Fairy, but as Pink Fairy. And I've seen, you know, I saw little columns here there of my colleagues in the Free Press who would fall for this stuff. I know one guy who was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize on the basis of FBI files, and this goes on. So if you're ever curious about journalism in this country, I suggest that instead of investigating the Missouri School of Journalism to see how well they train people, you just, again, you turn to that most helpful of domestic agencies, the FBI. But at any rate, so my knowledge of the SDS, for instance, which is, that's a secret code word for something that I'm not at liberty to reveal to you. It's probably subversive in New York to even talk about. There's a criminal anarchy law in New York, as a matter of fact, so you're all under arrest because I am a criminal and an anarchist. So you're in deep trouble. But at any rate, so my knowledge of SDS was that, you know, they'd all been landed from a submarine, obviously. The only question was whether it was a Chinese or a Russian submarine, but that's really, to the FBI, that incidentally is an unimportant issue, because they think still it appears that it's a gigantic plot in which the Chinese and the Soviet Union have conspired to confuse us by arguing over trivial matters like human freedom, which is a trivial matter to the FBI, I'll admit. But nevertheless, they, so I had a lot of information about these terrible people, and I was about to, or could have let it go at that, except that after I discovered that I had made a few mistakes about other things, I thought I'd look into even such things as that. And that really is a shock. As I began to read about and to meet people in SDS, to discover that what they were doing mainly was living out the Republican platforms that I'd worked on. I'd written two of the damn things, and they had talked incessantly about community organizing and local control, you know. And so here is an organization of red rat subversives whose entire position is in community organizing. And in the New York and Chicago projects, they were doing something about it. So I figured, well, this is really worth looking into. And after I looked into it, it was irresistible. So I joined, which produced a curious situation, which was that in 1968, because I still think that Senator Barry Goldwater at that time was the best, absolutely best man I'd ever met in American politics, I went out to Arizona and helped on the 68 campaign. I was a member of SDS, which might seem curious, except when I talked to him about it, and I said, before you have apoplexy, maybe you should read some of the material. I read him the whole middle section of the Port Huron statement, which now seems really, if you read that lately? How wonderfully dated it seems. It seems like a colonial document of protest. But nevertheless, it's a good statement and a moderate, very mild statement. I read him this thing. He was bowled over. His first words were, my God, did Yaff write that? That's the Young Americans for Freedom, which is a comic organization, which is neither young. It's very American. Has nothing to do with freedom, however, but one out of three is not bad for a name. So he was turned on by this, and we discussed this for a time, and in 1968, actually, in his campaign for the Senate, he made a speech that began with, I have much in common with the anarchist wing of SDS. Which, in fact, at that time was true. And it also showed that he was beginning to, as many of us felt was necessary somewhere along the line, was even beginning to pick his way through the factions of SDS. And the historians among you will immediately recognize that he was allying himself with the faction that later became the Weather People. So in a way, he was one of the first Weather fellow travelers. Which is interesting. As a matter of fact, the first Weather person I ever met came up to me and said, we met before on some hotel in San Francisco, and I said, that seemed unlikely, but he said, no, I was a Youth for Goldwater leader. And I said, what a strange place to find you in now. And he said, not at all, and I think that it's reasonable. In other words, the position, except for an analysis which even the Weather People later renounced, the general, there was much in the first Weatherman statement that was quite consistent with the sort of old right attitude that Goldwater had at one time had. But as I say, that's all gone now. He's a successful Southern politician, and there are changes. Well, that's to just get us up to date, I guess, and pardon me for such a long digression. But I would like to, I guess, from that, leap into trying to work with some of you who are concerned by organizing matters particularly, to talk to you about what sort of attitudes working people whom you consider to be conservative have, what those attitudes are based on, and how you might relate to them, because I think this is very important. One of the first things to think about is the stupendous, the very strange notion of individualism that has permeated of the American educational system, which is an arm of the state, has a very specific notion in mind. Now, approach it this way. It is required for capitalism that people have certain very important attitudes. One crucial attitude is that they not be cooperative and that they not organize together for common purposes. In short, that it is essential to the success of capitalism that people are committed to the proposition that the only salvation possible to a person is isolated salvation, so that you have the concept of individualism, which in Marx and in others and in the works of the anarchists particularly is so different from isolation. You have a situation where individualism has come specifically and purposefully in this country through the educational system to mean not in individuation of any sort, it has come to mean isolation. That is to say, you must be separated from other people. Now, out of this, you get a lot of people who talk about individual. They want to be free. There's a rhetoric of individualism that attaches to people who are supposed to be conservative that must be understood as distorted through this process to mean actually isolation. That is, to the conviction that it is impossible to cooperate, that it is dangerous to, and so forth. Now, a lot of working people have really bought this, and for very good reasons. My point about this is not a characterological defect. It does not mean that people who work are innately conservative or that they have some genetic philosophy about isolationist individualism. I don't think that's true at all. I think that it is an acculturation process and that it can be broken somewhere along the line. The early trade union movement, of course, was nothing but an organized attempt to break that. Now, what came out of that, of course, was a tragic situation that we have to deal with also. And I think that could be described very roughly as the fact that you had in this country not only a radical trade union movement, but an importantly radical one. That, of course, was the Industrial Workers of the World. Whose position, interestingly enough, a position which I think with rather American sort of native ingenuity was a, if you look at it closely, a great synthesis of Marx and Bakunin, really. In other words, it was based upon an organizational concept that used historical Marxism and Bakuninist organizational principles. I think that that is true. So I think the IWW is important to study for an immense number of reasons. But nevertheless, there was this attack on capitalism, a radical critique that I think was absolutely valid about particularly the notion, as the IWW preamble stated it, that people who work and people who own have absolutely nothing in common, a radical position. Now, opposed to this, of course, were the really conservative trade unionists like Gompers, who said that is not true. They said, in fact, we have everything in common, and as trade union leaders, most of them ever since then, have been prepared to do, they have accepted the fact that of the trickle-down, in short, that people who work have a survival interest in common with people who own, and they also should be prepared to admit that they are simply never going to get a really fair share. They will have to struggle on and on just to get some share. But that under Gomperism, it's sort of established in the American trade union movement that the notion is that there are the great, the mighty, and the rich, and that there are also these all the rest of us, and that their success, no matter how grand, will result in some sort of a trickle-down. So what you should do is, as loyally as possible, work for the success of the people at the top. which is exactly what has gone on. Then you have added to that, again, an organizational way to put into effect this notion of isolationism, that people must always be isolated. And that, of course, is the notion of the grievance procedure and the contract itself. When a union signs a contract, the union bureaucracy's loyalty is to what? To the workers? Of course not. It's to the contract. The union bureaucracy supports it. Secondly, in the grievance procedure, the workers themselves are, again, they're all separated from the notion, they say the old IWW notion, which was an injury to one is an injury to all. They are separated from that into the a process in which an individual separating himself from the conditions of everybody with whom he works can go into the grievance procedure and get an individual solution, which, of course, is, in long-range terms, this is really to get nothing. That is to say, you get a temporary relief, but you don't get a solution at all. But what you do get is this tremendous sense of isolationism and an anti-organizational sense. Now, that is something that people who are interested in folks who work have got to appreciate, that is a long process. Now, I think it is beginning to break down in certain very important aspects. For instance, when the head of the meat cutters union called for a general strike after, what's his name, the current king, announced the wage price freeze, that's an indication that something's beginning to break down. And of course, I think his position about that is absolutely accurate. In short, the wage price freeze is a wage freeze, not a price freeze, as is abundantly clear from yesterday's announcements. Again, the king comes on. I worked for that guy once, which, if it's a good thing I'm an atheist, because if I believed in a heaven and hell, I'd be laying in asbestos stock real fast, because can you imagine having worked for Richard Nixon? It's a sin beyond any forgiving, I'm sure. So, as I say, it's good not to be mystic when you've done that. So, as a matter of fact, let me digress to tell you something about that guy that pops into mind as I think about him. I once was sitting in a room with the guy who wrote Six Crises for him, and with a guy who'd written his first biography, not autobiography, that's somebody else is going to be writing that, I guess. And the guy who had written the first biography of him was saying, and these are guys who liked him, incidentally, I must say that, so that what I'm about to say does not come from critics, it comes from the just perceptive friends. This guy said, I think I'll write a novel about Richard Nixon. And the guy who'd written Six Crises, or parts of Six Crises, said, that's very droll. How can you do that? It's my understanding that a novel requires a central character. Now, it is true. I mean, he's the invisible man of 20th century morality, ethics, and politics, as far as I'm concerned. If he's a person, I want to really see the doctor's report on it. But nevertheless, when Nixon does this wage price freeze thing, as I say, he set up. See, I think what he did was to be a little arrogant, which is not an unknown quality among politicians. You remember at the Lincoln Memorial during one of the demonstrations when he came down to quiet the beasts and he talked about surfing and baseball while everybody was getting ready to trash the city? Well, he's that kind of guy. Now, you might think that this is just bone stupid, because it is possible to look at that guy and figure that he's some sort of a case of arrested something. But I'm not too sure that it is altogether just that. I would give him the benefit of some doubts in this and think that part of it is a very clever reading of reality. When he chooses to go to the wage price freeze, and when he chooses to fight inflation the way he does, I think what he's saying is that, look, we have forgot what a grand cooling off tool joblessness is, not for monetary inflation, but for political unrest. And lo and behold, see, I think in that case he has really been very smart. I think that much more than Kent State or anything like that, that the recession has been one of the most important population control measures that the American state has ever taken. And I suspect that it is going to continue to be a very important one. That is to say, the de-affluencing of America is underway. A very important point that in all organizing that anybody gets into is going to be part of the equation. More and more people will be scared away from militant activity simply because they are terrified at the notion of not having a job. Yeah. And because we've also done such a dandy job in this country of convincing people, of making people forget a time when, like in the 30s, when millions of people didn't have jobs and they simply organized to take funds. You know, we got away from that, and now it's just sort of a sin. It's a social sin not to have a job, and a lot of people believe this. Again, people who believe this should not be reviled as somehow hopelessly middle class. What they are people who forgot about class for a time, and one of the great responsibilities, it occurs to me, of all people who have any sort of left politics at all, and I assume you know, that some of you do, and the rest of you, you might as well know the battle plan anyway, since you get it in your reports from National Review anyhow. The point is to try to make people in this country remember that we are not magically exempt from a class structure. That Nelson Rockefeller is not a person who just happens to be a little richer than you. He occupies a world of interest totally different from yours. He is, in effect, in a position. You are in various positions. Now, a lot of working people have sort of forgot that, and through a lot of very antiseptic propaganda have been urged to, not the least of which, incidentally, has been the propaganda of the trade unions, which have consistently spoken against class struggle in this country, so that you have a lot of people who have to be reminded that they have a class interest, that they have an interest that is absolutely different from that of the stockholders, for instance. Now, there's some people, and particularly a lot of my friends from the right, who hold to, well, say, laissez-faire capitalist theory, who will immediately make a comment which in theory is very accurate, because they, when it comes to theory, these are accurate, commendable, and very responsible people. And their notions are not to be lightly glossed over. They would say, aha, you forget, however, that there are 20 million stockholders in this country. Therefore, the interests of the owners of industry in this country are really more diffused than you say. And that because of the stock corporation, we have demolished class in this country. That's a theory only. In practice, it is absolutely not true, because the corporate stock, although it may have 20 million individual holders, is owned by, at the most, when I say owned by, I mean 85% of it is owned by 200,000 families. 85% of it. That's a little less than 1%. Well, it's much less than 1% of the families of the country. In adult population, the figure is actually, it's about 1.5% of the adult population. 85% of the corporate stock. Now, that's absolute ownership of the means of production, not by a people, but by a class of people. Now, it's difficult sometimes for a guy who really, you know, he's a steel worker, and until recently things have been going pretty good. And there was the possibility of a seemingly endless upward mobility. His kids were going to go to college, some of them not to a state college, but some of them maybe to what he regards as a real college. He has cars, a car. He may even have a piece of property someplace and so forth. Now, the tendency for such people to identify themselves as classless or to identify their interests with a ruling or managerial class is irresistible. And I think it should be kept in mind. It should also be kept in mind that there are probably no arguments that will move such a person Only concrete realities will. That is to say, when the condition of these people, as inevitably it is, it seems to be today, becomes intolerable, then they will have to move. And because many industrial workers are involved in unions which at least, even though the leadership would not be responsible for this at all, at least have a structural culture of organization and cooperation, many of these people may, as material conditions change, begin to organize themselves. Now, there are examples of this already, and the miners would be a paramount one. That is, the situation among coal miners, as is widely familiar, that they were unable to fight the black lung disease and everything else because they had to fight both the mine owners and the union itself, which has systematically repressed not mine owners, which with whom they've cooperated excessively, but they have repressed workers. The UMW is as repressive a union as there is in terms of representing workers. It does not. It represents the again, a class within a class sort of situation in which a number of union bureaucrats have become immensely wealthy. For instance, their ownership of a bank in Washington is an example of this, a bank which holds union pension funds for no interest, for instance. Well, now, the miners themselves, about 2 years ago, organized one of the most amazing wildcat strikes in American history, which started with a few people and spread to all of the coal fields within a week, and absolutely shut down coal production and forced the first changes in the organization of work in the mines that would at least take steps toward making it possible for a miner to survive. As you know, all miners as of now who have been working for a number of years in coal mines are going to die substantially earlier than most people and will spend their last few years in a fairly wretched medical condition. That is, they will not be able to sleep like us. They will not be able to breathe very well. I mean, this is and for those who say, oh, well, what the hell? I mean, nobody forced them to be coal miners. I suggest that you take your rarefied theory about choice and go live in Appalachia for a time, and then see if it really is a question of being able to say so glibly, oh, well, they have choice in a free society. Why didn't they become corporate vice presidents like my daddy, whose daddy was the president? Well, this sort of rank-and-file activity is surely growing, and it indicates to me rank-and-file activities very often are class-based and class-conscious. Now, a variation of this is the Lordstown situation today, which is, I don't know, it's a variation along youth culture lines, in a way, for people who wondered whatever happened to it. Lordstown may have happened to it. The average age of the workers at Lordstown, that's the big Vega plant in Ohio that is striking now over working conditions, which will make it probably the largest modern strike over working conditions. It's not an economic strike at all. It's a social strike and a political strike. The average age of the workers there is 23. Now, I think there's something that is happening there. I think that what is happening is not the sort of Reichian youth culture that some people had felt was going to lead the world to salvation. It is simply a rebellious sort of culture of people who, for many other reasons, do not feel that it is absolutely necessary to put up with everything that a boss says you should put up with. In short, whereas their parents were taught in school absolute obedience, the schools, by the time they got to them, had so crumbled anyway and had so decayed. The public school system in this country, very wonderfully, is now doing exactly what it should have done in any free society generations ago, disappearing under its own rotten weight. Now, in the collapse of the public school system, a collapse, incidentally, which is absolutely crucial, I think, to freedom, the notion of a state school system is next to the notion of a state military the absolutely most pernicious idea, it occurs to me, that men have ever conceived, because there is no way that has been found so far to divorce education from the aims of the state itself. And the state has, as someone very properly remarked, always been the executive committee of the ruling class. The same thing is true, I hasten to add, in state socialist countries, where it remains still precisely that. I would say that China represents the first major escape from that of any state organization, because the education is so totally divorced now and so decentralized, as is their economy, that you can say something new is happening there, but you can't say it in this country. So, as I say, in the collapse of the state education system, you've got people who, you know, there was very little authority to respect. So that, I think, is the sort of youth culture possibility that you see at Lordstown, but you see this larger possibility of young workers beginning to strike for social reasons rather than economic reasons. Because as a matter of fact, the difference between $2.10 an hour and $2.50 an hour at the current rate of inflation, as everybody knows, is nothing. Industrial wages have been static for a couple of years despite the rise in the numbers. And you can't beat that by just asking for more numbers. You have got to start approaching an attack against the relationships of ownership in this country. And again, I take very seriously the right libertarian notions of property and so forth, which some of which were reflected in the Supreme Court decision this week, which said that poor people have property rights. That's the first time. You know, before you could take abuses over $10,000 to federal courts. Now the Supreme Court has said that any attacks against the property rights of individuals can be taken to federal court, which means that a person whose wages are garnished by a creditor can now take that to a federal court. And of course it is to be hoped that everybody who has any dealings with any loaning agencies, whether banks or savings or loans or what have you, will undertake deliberately and from this point forward to take every relationship that they have with these people to every court they can get into, because they are in, it's an important attack, I think. How would you?
No, I was just trying to...
Well, particularly if your wages are garnished, get in touch with a law commune as quickly as possible. I assume there is one in Albany, or call Jack. Get a lawyer now to test the possibilities of taking this before a federal court, because the practices of small credit companies, particularly in harassing people and in collecting debts and in charging fantastic interests, in many cases hidden interests, are so pernicious that they should be attacked. And now there's this action. But I want to get back to this point. The point is that when we talk about readjusting the relationship of people who work to people who own, it is really not in contradiction to older notions of property rights, particularly Lockean ones. And it's certainly, for people who take a right libertarian viewpoint, it should not be considered to be some sort of assault on some sacred doctrine. The point is, and you've got the best example of it of all right in the state, the point is that Nelson Rockefeller does not own anything in any moral sense that has ever come to my attention. As I say, everything that he owns, supposedly, is owned by collaboration with the state. In short, collaboration with an agency of force. I mean, the old man didn't set up Standard Oil because he is some heroic capitalist genius out of an Ayn Rand novel, you know, who can do calculus with one hand and reads Greek with the other or something. The guy was a common, ordinary, ward-healing bum who used the state to set up these things, preferential freight rates and so on. There's nothing in that that smacks of productive work to create anything. And the same is true, you know, like people who say, well, what about Andrew Carnegie? He created the steel industry. Bullshit. A guy named Bessemer created the steel industry. And
workers
if you, and of course, that's right. But I mean, technically, Bessemer comes along with the process that makes the thing possible, and then workers then create an industry out of an invention. That's good. That's a good point. A very good point.
When you're talking about like Rockefeller stealing, even if he had no collusion, I mean, what about stealing? The fact that he steals, you know, his relationship to the workers, I think that would be another thing. That he doesn't own anything because if the workers got paid what they deserved, he'd never have a penny. And, you know, I mean, they've added all the value that he stole.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I'm saying that even by the terms of the most strict concepts of property, which would be Lockean concepts. The oldest concepts you can find, the guy is an illegal owner. I mean, that's the point. And of course, by those terms, which, I mean, I think that's really self-evident, no Rockefeller worked, or does, for that matter. So when you talk about, readjusting that sort of relationship, it is in a strange way, it is no assault on property. What it is a recreation of some humane notion of property. That is the notion of people creating things by work, by labor. And if people create something by labor, you assume that they are, in that instance, the sort of classically, if you use the word own, they become the owner of it. Now, social organizations can then modify that as the people involved in the social organizations wish. See, the point I make about that is, and I guess it's really sort of a recondite point that I'm sure bothers you some, but the point is you can't have any abstracts in these things. That is to say, people do create things, and finite and distinct people create things. Now, you can then, as I say, you can have social arrangements to identify ownership in modification of the people who created. You can say that we will agree that you're going to create tractors and we're going to create gasoline. We're going to own them, in effect, jointly. But it's still there's unless you're prepared to say that there's some that you can turn it over to an abstraction like the state. You've got to always be involved with people. That is to say, a Chinese commune is a specific group of people growing a specific crop, manufacturing specific industrial goods on the periphery of it, and having a specific relationship to all other communes, not an abstraction, in short. I mean, workers creating values and then in cooperation with others either redistributing it or exchanging it. And that's the point I make about that. Because there's still some people who are just terribly squeamish about the idea of Nelson Rockefeller. And again, I make this point because some of these people who are squeamish about it are people who work in Standard Oil, are oil workers, who are very quick to say to people from the left, uh-oh, look, that really means you want to take my things away from me. They are quick to equate, and I think this has got to be taken into your work, into account. They're quick to equate, say, the confiscation of Nelson Rockefeller's wealth with the confiscation of whatever they have. Mm-hmm. Now, whatever they have is very probably nothing, in as much as there are very few people who own anything in a technical sense, because consumer debt is so high, and so is mortgage debt, that it indicates that few people, say, own houses in this country. But if a person did, it would be difficult to say that a revolutionary social change would hinge on taking that oil worker's house away from it, because among other things, who would you give it to? See, but there still is a resistance among working people to discussions of such social change because that's the first thing they think of. And it is very important to make, I think, always a distinction between the property of a steel worker or an oil worker and the property of Nelson Rockefeller or a Carnegie. Yeah.
Go back to something you mentioned. I think that your interpretation of what Locke says about property is quite important, and I think that it's the way you've interpreted it is somewhat wrong. It seems to me that Locke is one of the first ideologists of early capitalism, which came and talked about people applying their labor to property, and thereby, you know, you can provide what is some sort of moral ground for property. He doesn't believe
Well, okay, but I think, you see, I think the point is that most of them start from the point that, look, if I make a chair, I consider the chair to be mine.
I think, which I think that is, that's okay, you know, we're talking about
yeah.
theory of value, but point, I think it's very important to point out that Locke does not end up with that theory.
Oh, okay, yeah, then that's good, and
it
should
be.
Yeah. Well, it's a, but in many cases it won't be a problem because that's exactly where it stops. The concept of property stops at that particular point, the producer being the owner. And particularly in relation to farms, that this is absolutely true. A lot of people feel that a farmer can should be said to own the crops that he grows. Now, you know, they've got some good points there, as a matter of fact. The point is that there are. It is also possible to imagine a farm with 5,000 people on it. Short, American concepts of ownership have always been very tight. It has always been supposed that ownership attached to a person, that only a person, a single person, could own anything. And I think that I think that's incorrect. But I think that's where a lot of these people are. And I just suggest that it really is. It is important in talking to people to try to keep in mind the difference in your concepts and the difference in their concepts. And I think this one is an important one, which a lot of conversations get stopped when the guy thinks that it really is his house you're after. Now, if it really is his house that you are after, I suppose that you should be someplace else organizing. You know, to go into a steel mill and tell everybody in the steel mill that what you want to do is dispossess them is likely not to get you very far. It's like starting a conversation with a Marine out with the notion that I'm sorry the VC didn't kill you. Now, the point is that if you could start the conversation out a bit more slowly, you might get him to say that he deserved to be. And indeed, many people in the GI movement will say that. But I assure you, I think that they didn't get to that position by somebody starting out by saying how totally wrong they were. In short, I think it is important to start the conversation at a level where you are agreeing about things rather than starting it out at the level of maximum possible disagreement. I have a Teamster friend who is an organizer for George Wallace. Who puts it this way? Well, he's had several comments that I think are important that should be pertinent to this. For instance, he came around a place where I spend a good deal of my time, which is the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, and he said that he was really amazed when he got there to find people on the left who were anti-capitalist. I see, that's sort of shocking to hear a person say that, but it was not his impression that the American left was anti-capitalist. And in this, I think he's talking like a revisionist historian. He has confused the American left with American liberalism, which is the greatest organizing force American capitalism has ever had. And he accurately has this confusion. Now he begins to say, oh, you mean the left is anti-capitalist? Yes. Well, so are a lot of us, he says. And you say, you mean that? I mean, you know what you're saying? He says, of course, look, we work, you know, we know this relationship. Those people are rob us. And a little later he gets to talking about, look, we fight the wars for those people, we make all of the profits for them, and we never get anything, and some of us are beginning to get mad. So you say, well, why George Wallace? And he says, who else? You know, you say, well, have you listened to George McGovern? And of course he laughs at you. And again, for a fairly, for a series of well-developed, accurate reasons. Nobody's ever talked to him about his exploitation. And he really, you then say, but George Wallace is against the Third World. And his first reaction would be, where's that? Because so far as he's concerned, he lives in it. The Third World to him is the inside of a big truck or a steel mill. That is a colony that he knows about. And the colonial warfare he has begun to understand is there. And it is a very poor tactic to start talking to an American, say an American tin miner, about Bolivian tin miners. To start talking. I mean, it's obvious that after you can talk to people, of course this is part of the conversation. So I'm really talking about introductions. Introductions to people you will be working with. They should be, as this guy said, well, he says, look, he also says, look, I'm a racist. And I say, okay, we just won't discuss that for a while. Because I say, was tempted and finally did get a chance to say, what do you mean by you're a racist? He says, well, I was brought up to think all of these things. His closest friend is black. So I figure we can wait and talk about that a little later. Racism to him means something entirely different than it means to a left theorist. Why, he then says, has the left always begun conversations with American working people at the area of maximum disagreement? Why couldn't we have started talking, he says, about the things we agree on? I think that's not bad advice. There have been two strikes in Mississippi. And incidentally, I have rarely heard the black workers bring this up. This is a white, it all, almost always is the first thing white people talk about, and about the second or third thing that black workers talk about. Nevertheless, in two strikes in Mississippi, the pulpwood strike very recently, which was won, and the Masonite strike at Laurel, which was lost, there was a collaboration between Klansmen, militant blacks, and young communists. Now, the collaboration came about because some kids came up from Louisiana, principally Louisiana and Kentucky, to this strike. And they said, well, first of all, they had information about the union leaders, and the guy they were to talk to was the Klan executioner. He was their roughest man. So it was a touchy situation, but they went to these people and said, look, we will not kid you. These are our credentials. These are stories that have been written about us. But we want you to know that we do have some skills that may be useful to you in this strike. We can do posters. We can organize food supplies. We've been in a lot of strikes. And this was about their first really big one at that plant, a sort of a live or die strike. Said, can we work together? Now, nobody else was supporting this union at all. It was really, everybody was against them. Pretty much, they had very little support. So in desperation, they said, yes, we will work with you. Now, within some weeks, all of these issues had come up, and the issue of racism was widely discussed. And the Klan's people had begun themselves to make the analysis that racism in their areas had been a very deliberate, long-term device to keep them separated from black workers. And they understood and put into action their understanding that from that point on, their futures and the futures of the black workers in the area had to be coincident, and were, always had been, but they had to be conscious of it. So that worked, and as I say, the collaboration continued into the pulpwood strike, which was won. And one of these, there were two comments out of that I found revealing, vignette comments. One of the black guys who had gone down to work on this said that although it was scary at first, he said that after a while he felt safer than he had ever felt in Mississippi, because he said none of these people had any liberal hang-ups about violence. If they said you were going to be safe, they meant you were going to be safe, and that they protected these people. On the other hand, one of the Klan's people came, got one of these guys aside, and really fractured him by saying, look, he said, I want you to know I've been a communist all my life. Well, the guy, after he picked himself up from the floor, said, what did he say? Well, he said, but I don't mean one of those phony communists. And then he lays out a good communal sort of native communist rap, a socialist rap that he had invented pretty much. Now, even that is possible. And it's a useful thing to note again, to note just a possibility. See, it would be easy to always talk about the things, again, that are easiest to talk about, like all left movements, but all left movements in this country are not, at this point, the most important movements. So to talk about these other mass movements, I think, is important. In short, there are mass movements underway in the country. One of them is a movement that at the moment is right populist that could become fascist. That's the Wallace movement. So I think it is important to talk about that, and it's important to find out, if possible, what sort of opportunities, chinks, openings there are in the armor of this movement. And there are, so far as I can see. In short, I think it's very important that you will meet up with Wallace people. And I think it would be at least worth the try to not start out arguing with them. That's the point about that. Keeping in mind your reservation. You don't know what the hell's going to happen. Well, I think he had a very distinct ideology. And I think it was pragmatically wrong. Oh, even for workers at that time. Because workers at that time had a better opportunity, I think, then than they have actually right this minute for actual struggle and for actual change. And he had a very ideological position, which was not necessary, because there was an overture, for instance, by de Leon from the socialists to Gompers. Gompers corresponded also with Engels very extensively, too. He made a lot of wishy-washy statements about how I really approve of socialism, but he never did anything about it. The point was, he really ideologically killed the socialist influence in the labor movement because he made this other decision. The decision was that capitalism was it, baby, and we're going to get our share of it. I don't know whether that you could say that was pragmatic on his part or ideological, come to think of it. He may have considered it pragmatic at the time, but it was that was a sharp moment in American history, it seems to me, and an unfortunate one. Now, I would certainly take his reservations into account that, look, if you were in Mississippi working on that strike and the conversation somehow never got off dead center, and you felt that you were there just helping a bunch of Klansmen to remain Klansmen, see, then I would say that even though you were attacking the Masonite Corporation, unless you had some overwhelming reason for attacking them, that the time to split would be obvious, that you wouldn't solve anything, that approach. But the thing that kept them there was that the conversation did grow, just as the conversation grew in the Richfield oil strike, where it started out with the pragmatic thing of SDS's support, and after a while it got to an explicit attack on the imperialism of the oil company and so forth. So I take that very seriously, what you say, and I hope everybody else would. And I make just that limited point that there have been tendencies that have advocated starting off with the harshest possible approach. In short, you see, factory worker is in front of you, and you're talking to him, and the first thing is to say, I'm a communist, and I want you to denounce American imperialism, castigate the nuclear family, and abolish all private property. You know, and what's this guy going to do? That's no way to start that conversation, is the point. And it's embarrassing in a way to bring it up, because I know so many of you are so far beyond it, but believe me, not everybody is beyond it, because there's one thing about socialist theory is that it's so goddamn compelling once you get into it, of course, that you may be tempted, like an early Christian convert or something, to just want to go out and win the world overnight. And I tell you, there's a long conversation that is involved in this, and so that. What do you make of this thing now with the pay board and Meany and these people? I find it a very curious situation. I mean, curious only because it now follows demands that were raised by a lot of rank and file groups at the outset. Do you think? I think there are two possibilities. One would be that they were responding, which it seems to me almost exotic. And the second is that what they really have caught on to is the fact that compulsory arbitration is coming down the track very rapidly, and that they may have to forge some kind of a new trade union unity in order to fight it. Because it looks like a sure thing. I mean, to me, it just seems that that's the next thing that comes out of.
You have to do that, otherwise you'll lose the workers. Otherwise the workers will stop being passive and they'll start organizing themselves.
Right? Well, that's, I wonder about that. That could be, yeah.
Opportunism depends on the success of imperialism, or it depends on the success of the economic success of the society. And without being able to, like, to more or less, like, bribe a certain section, like, of the working class, or, trickle down like larger benefits, like opportunism can't really succeed. So like the opportunist trade leaders, like as opportunists, I think will find it more and more difficult to succeed in those positions.
Well, I think so too, because I think Nixon, as I said earlier, is taking a very conscious position, a repressive position. And I think he really, this emphasis in this speech about Meany on the fact that there are only 17% of workers are organized is remarkable in a couple of ways. First, he's beginning. That's a struggle concept from his point of view. And secondly, shows an interesting concept of the working class. A working class, by that definition, is 80 million Americans. I wish, sometimes you look at left periodicals and you wish they had a definition as broad as that. A Nixon's really means everybody who works for a wage. And he's setting up, I mean, the son of a bitch may be the best thing that ever happened in a way, because he is getting so out front with these things that he establishes lines that would have been difficult to establish otherwise. For instance, I told Jack coming up here that there's a right-wing, not conservative, a publication called Human Events that in the past, because it had, when it was started, for instance, it was started by the guy who wrote Merchants of Death. So it was an old right publication, isolationist and anti-monopoly. But it's become a real right-wing thing now. But even so, its rhetoric has been careful. Now it's not careful at all. It had a piece in this current issue about the defeat of the bill to permit registration by mail. Now in the past, I'm sure they would have said that it was good to defeat it because it would have, I don't know, done something to individual freedom, or the right to vote is so precious that you should walk down the street for something like that, really a hidden language. This time the statement was that the bill should be opposed because it will permit persons in lower income groups to vote in larger numbers than ever before. Just like that. And Nixon's out front like that in some ways too, like this attack against a segment of the working class. So I don't know, it's a funny situation about that thing, yeah. In talking about the plans of the state or of capitalists generally, it is silly to think that they're going to inevitably succeed. Because as it turns out, they succeed less and less, not more and more. So I think there will be this attempt to control it, to sort of cool down the affluence so people once again become more preoccupied with jobs than they have been. And so that they'll be, to try to build up the competition. But God, I don't see how they can really control it, because the curious thing that's happening with the corporations now is that they're splitting. They're really the beginnings of the movement of the big corporations out of the country is so obvious. I've had recently reason to believe that, like, farm production is one of the first things that's going. Farm production is moving out of the country, as the big producing areas are going to be in the third world, in some of the British colonies, because it's a rough thing to do in this country, and it's been, this agribusiness is not very productive in this country. That's a curious thing. And Tenneco has got that huge thing going, but the evidence so far is that it's not a howling success. So the tendency of these guys to get out of the country means that the unemployment, for instance, could really get out of hand. And someday you may be faced with a situation where you look around and you discover, my God, capitalism is doing what it was clearly predictable that it could do. It's escaping a national base. It doesn't need a national base, absolutely. Look at that thing that Dow, the president of Dow, said a couple of weeks ago. Some bitch has a vision. He said, I have a vision of an island in the middle of an ocean that does belongs to no state. Sounds like Ayn Rand on a real trip. It belongs to no state that is only the headquarters of Dow Chemical, owing allegiance to nothing but Dow Chemical. And I tell you, you see, I don't think that's altogether funny. When a guy in a position like that can engage in flights of fancy of that sort, it just could indicate what these sons of bitches are talking about these days. Like if the place is no good, let's get out and go to Ceylon or something. So it's, I really think that they've got a lot of problems. Well, she's a very curious lady, as a matter of fact, because she says everything she's ever written about has already happened, which is a funny excuse for a lady like that to support Richard Nixon, the space program, and the police, and everything else. I don't take her very seriously, is the point about that. As a matter of fact, to anybody in here who has some sort of residual loyalty to her because she's exciting, I suggest that you read the original, which is just one hell of a lot better than the copy. Read Max Stirner, if that's what you're into, because it's the basis of everything that Ayn Rand has ever thought, except that Stirner was much more serious about it. And I think I would really respect people who said that they were Sternerites a lot more than people who say they're Randites, but that's just a literary suggestion, because neither one of them, it seems to me, is totally applicable to the way people actually live. So that's a, well, I sort of run out of ideas at this point, but if anybody wants to keep on going, I'd really like to learn something.
I just wanted to say, you said before that you call yourself an anarchist, and you also had, like, capitalism.